You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with David Johnson. He's in London at the moment. David, thanks so much for being with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's talk about your, I want to talk about your design practice and self-initiated projects, as well as your new idea of communal working space. But let's begin with, just to get a sense of your company, a recent project. If you could describe to us the project and a little bit how your company approaches it, perhaps.
Okay. Well, our biggest client is probably Nike, and we've been working with them for the last 10 years or so, doing all manner of different projects. Sometimes we work with the internal creative directors for the brand, working on their kind of ideas around creative directions and also product launches, and we work on pieces of actual branding for products as well. So we've always got like a whole bunch of projects going on with Nike at any one time. We're also working on a luxury outlet concept here in London called Hackney Walk. We've just completed the branding part of that project, and it will turn into a signage and wayfinding project as well. And we're also undertaking a lot of the marketing elements of that project. And very excitingly, in fact, we've just been told that we've been engaged to create a branding concept for Ministry of Sound, who are based here in London. And I can't say too much about the actual project, but it's very exciting, due for launch next September.
Wow, that is exciting. And, you know, as is clients like Nike, I mean, I don't know how many other designers they work with, but I would imagine having a client like Nike is somewhat extraordinary in your field.
Yes, it is. Everybody seems to want to work with them, and we've been very lucky to build up a relationship with them. We've been working with them since we started, really. And I think because they're such a creative and daring company, it's been a really great relationship. We've managed to produce work that we can be really proud of. And it's evolved. I mean, as it's gone on, we've made new friends, and friends have moved around to different departments. So that's why they've become our biggest client, really. But they're great, absolutely great to work with.
And I'd like to talk a little bit about what you call self-initiated projects. Can you tell me a little bit about what a self-initiated project is, how that relates to other work, and perhaps an example of one?
Yeah, so ever since we started, we've always liked the idea of creating work that wasn't commercial or it wasn't paid for, basically, just expressing ourselves through self-initiated projects. And a good example of that would be our light calendars, which we started 10 years ago. And they're basically data visualizations of the amount of hours and seconds of light and dark for the year ahead. So we started in 2006 by designing two posters, one for the hours of light and one for the hours of dark, for the year of 2007. And we've had to reimagine that data. It's slightly different every year, but it's very similar, effectively, and we've had to reimagine the way that we interpret that data. And we produce really beautiful white and black prints, which depicts that data. And we've been doing it for 10 years, which culminated in an exhibition about a month ago, here in London, of our 10 years of light and dark prints. So there were 20 posters on display, and you can see that on our Instagram feed and soon on our website. And that's really just the way that we can explore different approaches to design, I suppose, different ways of expressing data, which is something that's very dear to us, and doing it for no other reason than we love the process, really. We've gone on to actually create a gallery space ourselves, which is called 43M3, because it's 43 meters cubed. And that actually takes up the entrance part of our studio. So the entrance of our studio overlooks Kingsland Road here in the east end of London. And about four times a year, we put on displays of self-initiated work there, and all manner of things get put on there, one of which was actually a physical interpretation of data. And we took data from NASA, which was meteor strikes to the moon over a 10-year period, and then we played it out in a kind of metal floating blanket, which basically undulates and is driven by the data that was captured by NASA of meteor strikes to the surface of the moon. So it's a spectacular piece. It's also on our website, and we collaborated on that with a company based here in London called Fields, who are, I suppose you'd call, kind of art programmers or digital artists, if you like. And that was an excellent project. And we're always looking for ways to explore new areas that might not come through in our commercial briefs, but are of interest to us. So that's why we self-initiate briefs to ourselves.
So let me ask a little more about the light and dark calendar. That's a really fascinating project and kind of lovely in its conception. This is the light and dark data for a particular part of the world. Is that correct? Which is
it is. It's always from the perspective of London.
And so when viewers are looking at this light and dark print, this map, and listeners will be able to link to it through this interview so they can look at it. When people are looking at it, part of what they're understanding is how much light is in the year and the percentage of light. Like I'm trying to understand how that's digested by the viewer.
Well, first and foremost, they feel like beautiful artworks in truth. We like the idea that because we're doing them for ourselves, we can create something beautiful. So I think they often draw the viewer in just by being, they feel quite geometric. They're often kind of symmetrical. They're often kind of, you know, spherical in their form. And the data that generates them is very subtly printed within the surface of the print as well. So if you're drawn in by the initial visual, and then you start to decode what the visual is telling you through, you know, discovering the different elements of the print, it kind of explains itself to you. And that's something that's very important to us as well, this idea of layering narrative within our work. So the viewer kind of reveals the story themselves. But I imagine that people do buy them as artworks rather than as calendars. You can work them out, but they're you know, it's quite laborious to pick an actual day and figure out exactly how it relates to the data sometimes. But they're beautiful expressions of the data, and they're very exact in the way that we produce them.
I love that idea, and of course it sounds, you know, very much like an artist project, or it could be an artist project, and obviously is, though you're coming from a design perspective. This idea of data, which, as you were saying, is so dear to you, seems to be something that is becoming more and more used by social platforms and other things. And just correct me if this is a reach here, but you know, the way algorithms are set up, and you know, Facebook and all kinds of places are crunching what's called now, you know, big data to understand where their clients are. Does it relate to those kinds of ideas where we're now being like served ads based on what we're looking at, where, you know, so much of our movements in a way are quantified so that companies, you know,
I think, in honesty, that's not the inspiration behind our light calendars and our personal work often. I think we don't call ourselves artists, but we do believe that really great creative work of all sorts, from, you know, art to architecture and really great design, helps us look at the world in a different way and look at the world from a different perspective. And the fact that the sun sets and rises every single day, and it's this spectacular occurrence that you take for granted or you might not even notice. And the light calendars are actually a kind of reminder of that special moment in truth. And it helps you look at that moment from a different perspective, because we've brought it to life in a different way. But what you mentioned there is also very, very interesting. I mean, I've seen recently incredible data visualizations of the internet, for example, that look spectacular and in fact look like the inner workings of the brain, the way that the people kind of move around the internet once it's actually mapped feels a little bit like the way that the electrical kind of forces move around our brains. And that's quite a weird and wonderful notion, isn't it?
It is. Well, it also makes me think that, you know, in a sense, this kind of data, which in this process that, you know, you seem to like so much, is at once an aesthetic process, but also it is a way of communicating, just as graphs communicate. But by that same token, graphs can be sort of deceptive, or how they're presented can be not quite as accurate. For example, there's a recent thing going around in the States after the recent shootings here, saying, you know, this year in the States there was 365 mass shootings. Here's the spots where they occurred. But, you know, part of the problem with that statistic, though, you know, it is grim, and I don't want to defend that in any way, but is that the statistic isn't completely accurate. The graph isn't accurate because there is no definition for what a mass shooting is. So if a robber goes into a store and two people get shot, it's a mass shooting. This is why we haven't heard of the other 300 that are happening this year. So what I'm asking, I guess, is, you know, when quantifying data, visualizing data, is there also kind of an inherent bias that's being presented with that data?
There certainly can be, and I think that people use data in the way that is most beneficial to the point they're trying to make. I think in our commercial work, we're often asked to emphasize a certain point within data, or to kind of coax out the specific stories within data that are going to help either sell a product or sell an idea. Within our commercial work, we very much work along the philosophy of, we try and be clear and simple and have purpose. So not just data visualization, but branding work and all manner of work, we try and impose those three themes, which means that we like to reduce ideas down to its simplest form, and we like everything that we create to have a purpose. So there's no decoration. It's not just to make something beautiful for the sake of it. There'll always be reasons behind the scenes. That said, personally initiated work is often, we allow ourselves to be a lot more flamboyant almost and kind of expressive than we would necessarily be allowed by a client.
Which is wonderful, because that idea also is, you know, especially with light and dark and other things that you've done, it's also a type of self-knowledge, or not self-knowledge, but it is a type of knowledge that may affect how we look at things. The light and dark calendar, I mean, to go back to that, seems almost poetic in its interest or reach. And what I'm saying is that it seems to have a personal impact, because it's perhaps not pushing a brand or an idea, but it's also helping us understand something about the world or humanity and ourselves. Is that the case?
That's exactly it. And it also has the sort of the extra bonus of allowing us to develop different areas of our design skills. So as we've had to reimagine the data every year, they're often taken on by new designers that come and join us. So over the 10 years, various different designers have had a go at realizing this. And in a way, they've helped craft out the aesthetic of our studio, which is very black and white and sexy, in truth. These things are beautifully produced. They're silk screened by hand, using the very best inks and paper stocks that we can find. So they seem to be, our creative director and my business partner, Matt, describes them as the cornerstone of our work. And I think they're a good example, and I'd recommend that any studio that wants to develop itself is kind of self-initiating projects and trying to find out what they stand for by actually practicing certain briefs that they've instilled in themselves.
So it's a fascinating process, and I would agree. I'd also like to ask a little bit about the collaborative space that I know you're beginning, where a number of people can work together. Can you tell me a little bit about that that initiative, what that is, and how far along you are in that process?
Well, we have a space, again, here in the East End of London. It's about 6,000 square feet, and we're calling it, I mean, the phrase that's commonly used is co-working space or social working environment. But in a nutshell, it's going to be a space that's designed by us for the creative community to come and rent desk spaces by the month and come together and kind of work. There'll be various different creatives from varying stages of their career, so from individuals to design teams will be hopefully hiring the space. And professionals from different fields are going to work alongside each other, so sharing their skills. And that's, again, very much at the heart of what we practice as a design studio. Collaboration is at the very heart of what we do. And we believe that true progress can occur when really talented, hardworking minds from all creative fields come together.
So in that particular idea, which I love, and there's some examples of that in the United States, different, they're usually for businesses, you know, but there are businesses that, you know, are all startups of different kinds, and they share common office space. But in your, you know, that's rented out by desks with some common things like perhaps a place to eat or a conference room. In this scenario that you're creating, is the collaboration kind of organic through just people talking to one another? Because they all are individuals or individual, you know, firms in there. Or is there a way that collaboration is also encouraged in another way?
It will certainly be encouraged. You can't force these things. You know, they have to be sincere, but it will be encouraged through, we'll have a schedule of events where, you know, people come and talk within the space. You know, professionals that we work with, maybe our contacts at Nike or other clients or just creative people that we've collaborated with over the years, will come and give talks to this community that we're building. One of the things that I've found from researching the co-working spaces that we have here in London are that they can feel very themed and that it feels a little insincere in truth. And the people that go and work in them have to buy into the brand of the space. So we're very keen not to try and impose too much on this space. We want it to be organic in the respect that people, you know, hopefully come together and inspire each other. And the ideal scenario would be that they work together. But we're just really creating a really well-designed space where they can use it as their stage to perform in whatever way that they, you know, that suits them best. There will be an excellent cafe. There's also a very adaptable open space of about 2,000 square feet, which can be used for presentations or can be used for events, for launches or, you know, for fashion shows or for art shows. You know, there'll be all manner of different exciting things going on in there, and it will be constantly changing. The name of the initiative is going to be called Today, and we like this idea of Today as a name because one of our designers mentioned the idea, I think it's a kind of spiritual notion of you never put your hand in the same river twice, because obviously the river's flowing, and in the same way every day is different. So every day that people come into our co-working space is completely different, and anything can happen. And we're really just going to put the network and put the systems in place that people can hopefully make real progress and groundbreaking work with a bit of luck.
I like that very much. In closing, can you tell us a little bit about the gallery space that you have? And the reason I know you've mentioned it already a bit, but the reason I'm asking and in closing this interview is because for those that are in the area, perhaps that's one of the public spaces where they could come and see some of your work. So what I'm asking is, what is coming up in that space, and is it open to the public, and if so, at what hours?
Well, it overlooks Kingsland Road in London, which is between Shoreditch and Dalston, and it's more like a kind of billboard in a way, because we always create artworks that that people who are walking past can appreciate. Often the artworks don't look as good from the inside as they do from the outside. So really it's a gallery, but it's a window looking outside in truth. So people looking from the outside will have a better experience of the art that we put on there. And we do have another exhibition coming up in early February. We haven't got the name of it yet, but if you check our website and also our Instagram and Twitter accounts, things will be released early next year about the next events. And we do have often launches of the events, but then for the 6 or 8 weeks after the launch, people are just invited to appreciate it by commuting really up and down the street.
That's exciting. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And David, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been fascinating to hear about your approach and process.
Thank you very much for asking me. It's been great to talk to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.